From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
President Trump is now in a fight over the calls he makes to the families of dead American service members. Why? And what are American troops doing in Niger in the first place? Is the Trump administration in any position to be claiming the symbols of patriotism? David Frum doesn't think so. We'll discuss. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Also in this show, Presidents Bush and Obama have been obliquely criticizing the president. Bush complained of nationalism distorted into nativism and of a politics dominated by conspiracy theories, while Obama notes the rise of forces our country long thought dead and buried. Are they the right anti-Trump messengers, or is Trump a reaction to their failures? And later, Dan Schnur of the University of Southern California will join us to discuss the fight brewing among California progressives. All that plus the status of a bipartisan deal to undo Obamacare sabotage up ahead. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor of Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And our special guest is David Frum. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic and former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Approximately 2 weeks after four American Special Forces soldiers were killed in Niger, President Trump called to express condolences to their next of kin, including Maisha Johnson, the widow of Sergeant LaDavid Johnson of Florida. Ms. Johnson was at the time of the call with her congresswoman, Democrat Frederica Wilson, who then publicly described the widow's grief at Trump's comment that, quote, he knew what he was signing up for, but I guess it hurts anyway. Sergeant Johnson's mother told The Washington Post she felt the president had disrespected her and her son. So on Thursday, White House Chief of Staff General John Kelly, whose own son was killed in action in Afghanistan in 2011, took to the podium at the White House press briefing room to defend the president. Kelly said he knew what he was signing up for was a formulation he'd expressed to the president himself, meant to reflect the danger in the name of service to the country that soldiers willingly agree to take on. He attacked Congresswoman Wilson for going public with the content of a private conversation, and he said this.
And I thought, at least that was sacred. You know, when I was a kid growing up, a lot of things were sacred in our country. Women were sacred. Looked upon with great honor. That's obviously not the case anymore, as we see from recent cases. Life, the dignity of life, was sacred. That's gone. Religion, that seems to be gone as well. Gold Star families, I think that left in the convention over the summer. But I just thought the selfless devotion that brings a man or woman to die on the battlefield, I just thought that that might be sacred.
So where to begin here? I just feel like this is such a strange thing to say from the podium in the Trump White House, that religion and Gold Star families and women need to be treated as more sacred.
I agree with you, Josh. I think it's there's kind of eerie irony in General Kelly's deploring of the degradation of modern American society in defense of Trump, I mean, whose presidential campaign and administration has been marked by name-calling, harsh rhetoric about Muslims, Mexicans, allegations of sexual misconduct by more than a dozen women. I know that Rich wrote a column expressing dismay that this had become a controversy, that in fact the deadly night in Niger demanded more attention and scrutiny. But I do think we need to, you know, pay attention to Donald Trump's ongoing self-inflicted controversies and self-inflicted wounds and then focus on what we don't know. I thought McCain's words were interesting. Quote, the mindset over there that they're a unicameral government, McCain said, accusing the Trump administration of intentionally trying to keep Congress in dark about military's foreign entanglements. This is not a new problem. But I do think more attention needs to be paid to the sprawling network of bases that The Nation has written about, 46 or more, including drone bases on the African continent, which is bringing America into growing conflict through special ops and other ways in battles we should not be involved in. The policing of the world should not be America's mission.
Rich?
Yeah, I don't have any problem with the debate over this military operation and what went wrong and why and whether we should be there. I mean, that's part and parcel of democracy, this kind of debates we've had since the nation's founding. It's just this condolence controversy I find so dispiriting. I think it's the stupidest and most unworthy controversy of the entire year, which is saying a lot. And I just wish everyone would step back and cease and desist. Not that that's going to happen. And I think Trump, this family, whatever Trump said, it landed the wrong way. So, you know, that's the most important thing. But just in taking his statement in isolation about it, he knew what he signed up for, always struck me as unfair. And it's very likely he didn't mean this in a malicious or even a callous way. And the problem, though, with this president is there's an easy way out of this. There's even a way for him to, quote unquote, win this controversy. And that would be to say, you know what? I didn't mean to offend you. I'm sorry you offended you. I offended you. I'll do anything to convince you that my intentions were sincere. Instead, he's just with this constant reflex to hit back. So he says they're lying and they're fake media is playing them up and all the rest of it. But I was moved by John Kelly's statement. Obviously, a tremendous amount of personal authority and feeling went into it. And I wish everyone would just let that be the period on this and move on to the next stupid and unworthy thing.
But the strange thing, and I thought John Kelly's statement was very moving as well, but then he went on to attack Congresswoman Wilson and said that he had been at an event with her in 2015 where she had very inappropriately bragged about having gotten money from President Obama for this federal building that was named after two slain FBI agents in Miami. And now we've seen tape of that event, and that's not true. The congresswoman didn't say what John Kelly said. So I thought, you know, John Kelly obviously has enormous moral authority to speak on this. And I thought that what he described about the difficulty of having these conversations and no president is in a great place to have them, I thought that was fine and appropriate. But then he got sucked into the Trump vortex of having to have this fight with the congresswoman that he didn't need to have. He could have been the bigger man on that aspect of it and just, you know, not engaged with Congresswoman Wilson, who apparently is known to this family. And that's why she was there listening to this call. So even John Kelly, who's supposed to be the adult in the room, got dragged into this childish aspect of the fight, which I found very dispiriting.
Yeah, well, he's clearly offended by her having blown it up. And in a better world, she would have called John Kelly and said, you know what, I was in the car, very close to this family. I mentored this Green Beret soldier, and I want you to know they're crying when Trump called. And you know, you do something about it?
Offering condolences to families of service members killed in the line of duty is one of the most solemn exercises a president must undertake. In other countries, it may not be a president or a chief of state, but it is in ours. And there, it does expose Trump's lack of empathy, lack of grace. And to then slander and lie about his predecessors to justify his position, it's ongoing, but it does reveal something. And for John Kelly, not General Kelly, whose personal history is remarkable, and may more military men have, you know, to have skin, to have their sons in battle is one of the most powerful personal testaments to a belief in American service. But to see him use his authority on behalf of Trump to squander it in some ways was dispiriting, to use, I think, Rich's word.
David, what did you think about this controversy?
I don't find it unworthy or unimportant at all. I think we've learned an awful lot that we need to know, an awful lot that is very disturbing. Let's start with what we learned about the Trump White House. Look, Trump is an unempathetic, cruel, disdainful person. Everyone in his vicinity knows that because they have been subjected to it. So, okay, you have to work for him. You're a staff. He is the lawful president. So you would think what they would do is they would build systems to cope with that. Do not have him call grieving families. He is an unfeeling person. He will make it worse. Let's hire some beautiful writer and have beautiful letters go out. Let's have meetings with other people, but do not let the president do this. I mean, if the president couldn't throw a baseball, you wouldn't accept invitations to throw out the first ball. You know he's just going to look bad. The fact that the staff cannot be truthful to themselves about the kind of person they're working for, his deficiencies, and the fact that they can't work to cope with those in an area that, as important as it is to the families, does not have larger civil, you know, world historical meaning. That tells me it's like the endless failures of spelling and titles in their official documents. This is a broken staff, and that means many of us hope that there's someone there who says, well, if the president gives some order to start a war stupidly, surely the General Kelly will stop that. If General Kelly doesn't know to stop Trump from picking up the telephone to call a grieving family, that will lead to disaster. That's ominous. That's the first thing I found ominous. The second thing I found ominous is Like Rich, I found General Kelly's speech very moving, but I also found it extremely disturbing because what the speech revealed was a military man who was so profoundly alienated from civilian society, who has so little respect for the society he defends, that it may be, I can't imagine that anyone like General Kelly can feel sincere respect for Donald Trump, obviously not. But it tells me that he may not see the difference between Donald Trump and other civilians. They're all just unworthy. Last point, and this is the one, maybe the thing that gets me most worried and enraged. The Trump White House creates these mini controversies in which they seize the symbolism and cultural significance of patriotism. This is a White House suffused with the odor of disloyalty. They are connected to foreign powers in a way no president in American history and very few world leaders of any democracy in anybody's history have ever done. And the idea that they are claiming this language of honor, this is a White House where the head of government has connections to organized crime of a kind that have never before seen in American history, unfortunately sometimes seen in other countries. The idea that the Trump support is so indifferent to the reality of honor and patriotism that it can be duped by these culture war symbolisms, that's really alarming to me.
I saw Rich making a little bit of a face.
Well,
there.
Just the idea that they're all connected to a foreign power is, I would say, not proven at the very least. I mean, there was a story this week that got some play because Kellyanne Conway and a few others retweeted what turned out to be a fake Russian produced Twitter account, and it just seems that that's what we're getting from the Russian collusion story so far, and that means that they can't associate themselves with patriotic symbols of the United States seems just completely absurd.
But what
to
about
me.
Turkey rather than Russia? Because I think, you know, the...
Well, I think David is right about the corruption, the privatization of this administration. It is making money off its business. What is its business? It's hotels or the presidency? So there is, that corruption is very profound, the privatization of politics, the privatization of honor. And put aside collusion, there is a corruption, a normalization of corruption that corrodes and worries me as a younger generation, for example, looks out on politics. Is this a model?
You have a president who has been effusively publicly praising the autocratic leader of Turkey, who is undermining democracy and what was one of our important but tenuous NATO allies, or still is at least officially, who used his bodyguards to commit crimes on U.S. soil, attacking protesters against him. And then you've had a number of people in the Trump orbit with these weird business connections to the Turkish administration, including Mike Flynn. And I guess, you know, we can set aside Russia. In some sense, the Russia stuff has gotten so big that it's too toxic for Trump to touch. But isn't it unpatriotic and reflective of a lack of interest in American ideals that in these petty ways, in these ways that maybe don't get that noticed by the public, maybe don't undermine the largest and most important goals of the United States, that they would subsume themselves to an administration like Erdogan's administration in Turkey?
Well, it's certainly wrong. Wouldn't be the policy I would have or the posture I would have towards Erdogan. But I don't know whether it be unpatriotic. I mean, there's a period there. And you can argue as before we fully knew what Erdogan was, although it's been clear for quite a long time, when President Obama had called him more than any other foreign leader and had a closer relationship with him. Was that unpatriotic?
Yeah, I mean, Turkey's supposed to be a NATO anchor. I will say, though, that one thing that struck me with the killing of this journalist in Malta this past week, she was involved with the papers about corruption, the Panama Papers, is when Bush attacks the press in this country, attacks the media.
Trump attacks the media
as a check.
Come on, Katrina,
on
get
presidential.
With it.
But it does. Well, Bush began to lay the groundwork, as you know, Obama attacked the press too, but not in this vicious, consistent, incendiary way. I do think it emboldens Turkish attacks on the media, Russian attacks on the media, autocratic strongmen attacks on media freedoms in other countries, because they can point to the United States and say, well, look, I mean, you know, you got a president who's questioning media patriotism, media role. And I think that's a dangerous precedent.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with more on this. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. And our special guest is David Frum. He was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush and is now a senior editor at The Atlantic. David, you had a response to what Katrina was saying?
A response to the whole conversation. Look, I just want to mark what happened there a minute ago. I made the point that among the things that was disturbing about this condolence matter was the way that the Trump administration seizes the mantle and the symbols of patriotism while itself being suffused with this odor of disloyalty because of its connections to a hostile foreign power. That's how it came to power. And both the actual and the attempted rewards to that hostile foreign power. The sanctions that were voted by the Senate 97-2 on Russia, by the way, still haven't been implemented. The administration's refused to do that. And what everyone said was, let's bracket this. Because if this is true, it's too terrible to think about. So let's pivot to Turkey. Now, the connections between the Trump administration and Turkey are indeed disturbing, but they are the kind of corruption that we have seen in our less honorable administrations. It reminds me of the Clinton people in Indonesia. Too close, too dirty, but unfortunately familiar. What is the Russia story is unfamiliar. I don't know how people can, if it's true, and every day no evidence accumulates that it is false, and every day more evidence accumulates that it is true. We don't want to, as Rich says, we don't want to leap to beyond the evidence to a conclusion, but if your mind is drifting and you're thinking about it, if true, I don't know how you can think about anything else. And when the president picks these fights with Gold Star families, with NFL players over the symbology of the flag and makes these claims about the American nation, by which he means certain ethnic groups within the American nation, I don't know how you think about that without thinking, take that flag off your lapel.
Well, I think, David, with all respect, you're kind of doing a two-step, because on one hand you just say it's an odor, and on the other hand you say it's connections to a foreign power, and that's how they got elected. And then you say if you know they have these connections. So which is it? And I take the Russia story seriously. I want it to be investigated. I want to get the bottom of it. But I don't think you can pile these accusations upon suspicions upon accusations and come at the end of it that they shouldn't be able to fly an American flag over the White House.
What I come to is when, as they are not on defense on these Patriots. They're on offense. They're on offense against the NFL. And General Kelly just went on offense at that press conference, suggesting that everyone who was sympathetic to this Gold Star family was in some way. And by the way, I don't know what he meant by his reference to what happened at the Democratic Convention last summer, but there's some suggestion there that the Khan family, or at least those who gave the Khan family a platform to air their grief, that they were somehow betraying what was sacred in this nation. So this is the administration uses. I mean, basically, they're trying to talk as if they were the Nixon administration, make these kind of culture war fights, and they do it again and again. It's their go-to position. Yeah, it's
the
increasing
playbook.
Position. And meanwhile,
it's the old playbook. I mentioned the media. I mean, that was straight out of Pat Buchanan, Nixon's playbook.
Yeah, but it's the Nixon administration using under President Henry Wallace.
But I come back to the underlying. You know, there is the controversy over Trump's staggering lack of empathy, which you noted, David, and in this incident. But it is important to understand what is happening in Niger. I mean, the death, there were four people, and now it's becoming a Benghazi of sorts. But it's a deep underlying pathology of our politics and foreign policy that we have this sprawling network of bases that are leading our men and women into battle, into death, without any accountability, without any oversight. And I think that is something to focus on. And are we an empire or a democracy? It is very difficult to remain a democracy with these misadventures and these imperial misadventures abroad. And I think that's a fundamental underlying pathology, by the way, of current American politics and foreign policy that we are allowed to avert our eyes from because, yes, Russia and the collusion possibilities must be investigated. But that line of inquiry also allows many to avert their eyes from uniquely American pathologies which helped Donald Trump won. He is a crisis, a symptom, not a cause of our moment.
I think to take David head on here about basically like, why isn't this, you know, item 1, 2, and 3 on the agenda? Why am I less focused on this than the wide variety of Trump concerns that I have. It's that I look at what the Trump administration has actually delivered on the U.S.-Russia relationship, and I think that as with most areas of public policy, the answer is not very much. And I think that Trump's incompetence and Trump's inability to actually follow through on policy initiatives here has been a blessing. It's true they have not implemented the new sanctions in the manner that they ought to be, but I also don't see a lot of significant concessions that they've been able to give the Russians, even if they wish to. I see the
he's
Russians
been boxed in. He's been boxed in from, well, by the way, we should have a working relationship with Russia. That is lost in all of this. In order to resolve Syria, seriously, well, in order to resolve an escalating nuclear crisis, in order to resolve a set of issues, we should have a working relationship with Russia. I've worked in Moscow as a journalist. I have friends who are independent journalists who are dissidents in these times. Cold wars are bad for progressives. They empower the war parties, war budgets, and close space for dialogue and dissent and diplomacy, which we need. Why should we be treating Russia as a hostile adversary? I mean, I just think that's madness.
Well, I mean, for one thing, they interfered in the election. I don't think I agree with David that we can say that they influenced the outcome of the election for sure. But they certainly interfered in the election, and then they have, you know, to the extent that they wanted Donald Trump to win the election, in a way they made their own bed because they created a president who has no political space to do any of the things that the Russians would have wanted. And I see the Russians as one in a long series of marks for Donald Trump. Basically, there's a long list of people who thought they were going to get something from Donald Trump, including a lot of his voters. And I think to an extent, the Russians are on that list for people who thought that they were getting something really good out of this. And then in practice, are not getting that
much.
They're
going to turn to China.
to David's point about, you know, patriotism and how can this administration wrap itself in this, I see this as just one of many things where the question is, do they really have the best interests of America at heart? And I don't think that's just Russia. I think there's a wide variety of issues where the behavior of the Trump administration is at odds with the idea that they ought to have the flag, including the way the president has talked about other people who have given their lives in combat or families of other people who have given their lives in combat, including the cons, including John McCain. But David, I think that lays out my reasons for why I see this not as the overarching issue, but one of many issues.
I agree with Rich. It's very important not to overstep what we know. But when I think about why the events of this week have been so disturbing, that we have here real patriots and really patriotic presidents, by the way. President Bush and President Obama both were extraordinary in their concern for people who'd borne the battle. And I posted on Twitter this week just some of the stories about both presidents. There's an especially moving one that Dana Perino tells in her memoirs about President Bush. The idea that Donald Trump, of all the unworthy people to have such a thing in his mouth, would disparage the concern of his predecessors for the troops who followed their orders, that he would do that. I mean, it's disgusting from any, even if Donald Trump actually did care about veterans, it would be disgusting from him.
Well, let's.
But, you know, in terms of Bush's speech, and I know David, of course, was, I believe you were the author of the Axis of Evil speech for George W. You know, one praises Bush for speaking out against Trump and for basic values, though he didn't mention the name Trump. But the default position to Trump aren't policies that have failed us to date, which Bush reasserts, but policies that would revive a true definition of security, freedom, and democracy. And, you know, George W.'s tenure, I mean, let's get real here. He misled us into the Iraq War. On his watch, the U.S. formally became a nation that tortures people. He condoned warrantless and illegal wiretaps. He put through the Patriot Act with the consent of many in Congress. And he shredded treaties that made this country more secure. The Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty in 2002 was the cornerstone of nuclear nonproliferation. So I think we are wrong to, we can hold two different ideas in our head at one time. And just because Trump looms as a great and odious threat, Bush should not be viewed as some kind of prophet of values.
Let me play a little sound for this speech, and then I know Rich has something he wants to say about it.
The American dream of upward mobility seems out of reach for some who feel left behind in a changing economy. Discontent deepened and sharpened, partisan conflicts. Bigotry seems emboldened. Our politics seems more vulnerable to conspiracy theories and outright fabrication.
Rich, what did you think about this speech?
Well, I think there are a couple things. One is a critique of our political culture in general, and Trump is both a product of that and a cause of it. And then on a trade and foreign policy, it was very directly aimed at President Trump. And I think Bush is legitimately appalled by what he sees, and probably more than anything else, more than any of the substance, just the way Trump conducts himself and the character he's exhibiting in this office. Because Katrina has a long catalog of complaints against George W. Bush.
They're not complaints. It's reality-based grievances of real human
kind. Right, but
most
of them, you would argue some of them go to character because you think he lied us into war. We don't have to litigate that now. But I think most of them are just policy. And he was someone who cared a lot about character, cared a lot about the tone of the nation's debate, and cared very much and thought a lot about how he conducted himself as president and how it would be perceived as people. He was a deeply sincere and honorable man. And I hope with the passage of some time here that even his critics would realize that about him. And that it's something that sets him apart from the current occupant of the office.
But I think the policy is really important, and the policy played a really important role in laying the groundwork for Donald Trump to make his insurgent run. And I want to lay out a case here, and I want to know what David and all of you think about this, that basically Bush and to a lesser extent President Obama are really bad messengers for the idea about how terrible the rise of Donald Trump is in America. Because what did Bush do? First of all, led us into the Iraq War, which is widely now viewed as a disastrous foreign policy that set off this set of dominoes that has created a lot of the problems that we see today. And then domestically, he had this idea of the ownership society that ended up roughly translating into the idea that middle-class Americans ought to become real estate speculators and use their home equity to get a rising standard of living. And then this ended in tears and pain when the real estate bubble burst, driven in part by badly designed bank regulation that exposed a lot of ordinary people to great economic distress, about which they're very angry. Then President Obama ran for office claiming that he was going to renegotiate NAFTA, that he would withdraw from NAFTA if he couldn't get what he wanted, actually in a weird way saying very similar things to what President Trump said about NAFTA, then got into office, negotiated the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which trade skeptics tend to have thought was worse. He had a fairly soft prosecutorial touch with financial institutions in the Justice Department, whatever you think about the go-forward financial regulations. A lot of people were left very upset with the idea that basically big finance would go unpunished under both parties. This fueled the rise of Bernie Sanders. And he made an effort to unilaterally impose an immigration amnesty that gave a lot of fuel to the rise of Trumpism. Now, all of these were policy choices in both cases. I think that they were honest policy choices by President Bush and President Obama. But it was this establishment that made a lot of choices that led to a lot of things that caused a lot of misery in people's lives. And in a lot of cases, they were choices that were framed in a way that basically you had no option, that immigration had to converge toward this comprehensive immigration reform approach and would happen legislatively or executively. You had all of this disaster that happened in the financial crisis, and there was no choice but to do bailouts. It was correct to do the bailouts at the time, but basically you had this long policy record under both parties that I think made people open to a demagogue who would say that changes were possible. And so I feel like they bear a lot of the blame here and are not the right people to be out here talking about how terrible this rise is. David, I mean, you wrote speeches for President Bush. Am I wrong about that?
You are almost never wrong, but when you are wrong, Josh, I think you bring to it your same commitment to excellence that you bring to all your other work. Yes, you are spectacularly wrong here. You're not wrong in the story you tell, of course. One could tell the same story. I would date it to actually the bursting of the dot-com bubble, where there was a decade and a half where every brainwave that the elites of America and society have, from, you know, people should invest in day trading the stock market to the slow recovery from the all of these were calamities for most Americans. And yes, that lack of institutional success opened the way to Donald Trump. But two former presidents of the United States of opposite parties who have had a very difficult relationship. Obama slammed Bush for his first 2 years in office, speaking on the same day, maybe it's a coincidence, to warn of threats to American democracy from this present president, who, by the way, falsely, who just this a few days before, has falsely slurred both of them for on the one ground for which no one could ever criticize them, insufficient regard for their troops. I think that is a major thing. I've never heard of even one president at one time hitting a successor so hard, never mind two of opposing parties and different values on the same day delivering the same message.
They're trying
to say the hair's on fire, people, and whether you agree with Katrina about the Iraq war, whether you agree with Rich about the failure of the Obama economic policy, whatever you think about those things, the fundamental institutions of your country are in danger. Say jointly and on the same day, both President Obama and President Bush.
But I think there's a fundamental global phenomenon which we're not paying attention to, which has to do with attacks and distrust of what people view as failed establishment parties and politicians. Trump's highly improbable victory, derived largely from his reactionary populist critique of the failed, quote, establishment, supercharged by race bait appeals. And I don't think you can look out at our country, sitting where many people do, and think that the establishment, bipartisan establishment, hasn't discredited itself or failed the country. That doesn't mean it should lead to a Donald Trump. I mean, I do think Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump get lumped together in staggeringly wrong-headed, unfair ways. But the centrist policies of the past decades, I think, which you ticked off some of, Josh, have not been good to working people, ordinary people.
The failure or perceived failure, depending on where you sit, of the Bush administration discredited the governing elite of the Republican Party. It just did. Now, it was a somewhat delayed reaction because first you went to John McCain, who was, you know, before the rise of Donald Trump, seemed like, you know, a really out there maverick. But he basically agreed with the Bush foreign policy. It wasn't until you got Trump that you got the real reaction. And part of what was also happening was not just a reaction to the economic environment, and I would argue unwise Obama policies, but Obama was repudiated in the midterm elections in 2010 and never adjusted. In fact, governed on his own unilaterally, often, I would argue, illegally, and there was a reaction against that. So both of these guys, I agree with you, are not good messengers. They, you know, free country, that this is what they sincerely believe. Go out there and say it. But the political effect of this, especially the Bush part of it within the Republican Party, will be nil.
If I could just very briefly, there is a lot of chatter, especially where I sit, about, you know, Donald Trump's careening reckless ways and the danger that he will take us into a war. George W. is the president, I mean, you had criticized Obama for various things, who took us into a war, which may be the most disastrous war of certainly the 20th century, which has cost this country not only thousands in lives, millions for Iraqi deaths, but I think one estimate is $6 or $7 trillion. It has set the scene for what we witness now in the Middle East. It has destabilized our security. War is the ultimate failure, and whether he misled us into war or took us into war, I think that needs to be calculated in Bush's legacy.
I don't think Trump has the attention span for a large-scale ground war, but I worry about a nuclear exchange that could be a lot deadlier for the world than, you know, I think, you know, that very bad things have happened under previous presidents, but I think we have to be open to certain tail risk ideas.
President Bush unraveled a set of treaties that again laid the groundwork for escalation of nuclear conflict. It is the case that Donald Trump, in addition to violating norms of decency of discourse, has opened the door to more conversations about the use of nuclear weapons, which is extraordinarily dangerous.
We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back on a little bit of a smaller scale issue and talk about Obamacare sabotage. You've been listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine. And our special guest is David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic. So let's talk about an effort to actually fix a policy problem in Washington. After President Trump cut off the so-called CSR payments to health insurers that participate in Obamacare, these are the payments that compensate insurers for their obligations to cover some additional costs for low-income participants in Obamacare. There's been some movement in Congress toward a bipartisan fix to make the payments and otherwise fix health insurance markets, make them a little more stable and more flexible. Republican Senator Lamar Alexander and Democratic Senator Patty Murray now have 22 co-sponsors, 11 Republicans and 11 Democrats, standing with them in favor of a two-year fix for the markets. But Paul Ryan has expressed opposition to such a deal, and the president has been inscrutable on the subject, seemingly changing his position by the hour. What's going on here? What have you made of the, you know, the president says, you know, I like Lamar Alexander. I like the deal they're working on. I don't want a bailout for insurance companies. It seems like it's impossible to tell what he actually thinks.
Yeah,
about
he doesn't
thing.
Know his own mind, because as we talked about last week, I believe the political logic of his ending of these CSR payments was it wasn't going to pressure Democrats, because they just turn around and say, oh, you're sabotaging the system. Anything that's wrong and any public discontent over it is your fault. It would have the political effect of pressuring Republicans, especially more moderate Republicans who are sensitive to these sort of things. And he was actually calling, you know, he was drunk dialing Lamar Alexander all the time, saying, Lamar, go do this. Talk to Patty Murray, hammer out this deal. And earlier this week on Monday, he was actually taking credit. You know, they wouldn't be talking to each other on Capitol Hill if I hadn't ended these CSR payments. And then he went to a vague noncommittal mode, and now he's opposed. So it just goes to he doesn't know whether he wants to govern as his self-image as the ultimate deal maker, or he wants to govern as an anti-establishmentarianism who's basically on board with the House Freedom Caucus that would oppose this sort of deal. So it's hard enough to get an administration to cohere when the president actually knows what he's wants to do. It's impossible when the president doesn't know.
It seems to me like the president has two goals here. One is that he wants insurance markets to unravel so that he can talk about how Obamacare has failed and so he can force repeal through. And the other thing is he doesn't want to be blamed for the unraveling of insurance markets. And I think he doesn't understand that these goals are incompatible, and it depends on which goal is in his head. And he realizes he's going to get blamed for something, and then he talks about wanting a deal, but then he realizes that will prop up Obamacare. It's like he literally doesn't get that there is no strategy for all
but
the
I
outcomes
think
that he wants.
What Democrats need to get is to make sure that the GOP owns healthcare in 2018. We talked about it last week. I mean, the Pottery Barn rule, right? You break it, you fix it. And Democrats need to begin to drive home that there are alternatives to this incoherence, which is not only incoherent, it's cruel.
David, what have you thought about this fight?
I think it is part of the bargaining phase by which the Republican Party is coming to terms with the fact that Obamacare is here to stay. And I think there are very few Republicans who now dissent from that. They understand it. It's painful. My suggestion, my advice to Republicans is the smart thing to do from a point of view of party management is as rapidly as possible to repeal the highly redistributive surtaxes that purport to finance Obamacare. They don't really, but they're sort of a protuberant ticket item.
These are the high income taxes that were part of
the
Obamacare.
Surtax on high incomes and the special tax on capital transactions that are supposed to pay for it. Take that bone out of your donor's throat. It doesn't raise that much money. You can find money somewhere else. I've got some suggestions about how to do that. Repeal those. And suddenly you can take the temperature down on Obamacare and get and say, it's here to stay. The Republican Party can now finance it in a way that it finds less objectionable. And now let's find ways to make it work that are somewhat
that
less redistributive.
Alienates everyone.
I don't think that's right. I think there are certain elements of the donor class where that's the primary concern, but I think the biggest complaint that Republicans, both voters and a lot of the donors have, is they don't like the spending in Obamacare. They see the expansion of Medicaid as something that, you know, drives up the cost of government that will be paid for by taxes sooner or later. I mean, you saw, David, when they were trying to get various repeal measures through, one of the things they actually took out was they said, we'll leave those taxes in place because we don't want this to be a fight over taxes on high-income people. We want to repeal the spending in Obamacare. We'll worry about the taxes later. So I think the problem, the coming to terms, is a lot harder than you're describing there, because I think there are distinct parts of the coalition that have different things they hate about Obamacare. And so it's not like you can repeal one of those and then the thing that the party hated about Obamacare is gone.
I think that's clearly true. But if you're thinking about this is from a Republican coalition management point of view, if you're trying to think, how do you build a consensus in the party to deal with reality as it exists and is going to be? The first step is to get the donors less exercised about this special tax on them. Then once it's there, then I think the Republican Party can find its true mission in the healthcare debate, which is to be the party that says, "Okay, we hate the costs. We're the party of low taxes. We don't want to pay the taxes of this very expensive healthcare system," and that means we have to be the party that is that is skeptical of the claims of providers and that sees our mission as driving down healthcare costs. You know, when your healthcare costs are 4 points of GDP higher than anybody else's in the developed world, you can squeeze a lot out of that system before you begin to in any way impede real meaningful healthcare delivery. And that's, to my mind, that's the 21st century future of the Republican Party. Let the Democrats be the party that explains why every spending demand has to go ahead, even if it doesn't yield health care benefits. Let the Republicans be the party who fight for taxpayers and the cost
of insurance. Rich looks skeptical about this.
Enter the 21st century joining that Western industrialized world, David, and talk about Medicare for all. I'm sorry, over to Rich.
I just don't see donors being the motive force for the effort to repeal Obamacare. I know, you know, a fair amount of these donors, some of them are friends of mine. I've never heard them express this complaint that Dave is raising about Obamacare. I would think if the party decides it just can't repeal and replace, and I'm going to be a dead ender on this one myself, but I think the midpoint would be, all right, we're going to create as many exit ramps as possible from the exchanges towards the goal of not eliminating the exchanges, but over time making them in effect kind of high-risk pools for sick people and for low-income people who either can't get insurance or can't afford it, and we have as deregulated as possible a system for everyone else.
Well, I'm gonna have to leave it there on healthcare. This is an issue that I'm sure we'll be back week after week after week. Let's turn to the states now. Steve Bannon has been running around the country recruiting primary challengers to Republican senators he sees as insufficiently pro-Trump, and now Democrats have some primary action of their own. Senator Dianne Feinstein, the moderate Democrat from California, has declared she will run for a sixth term in the Senate, but she has a challenge from her left. Kevin DeLeon, the president of the California State Senate, will seek to unseat her amid discontent that she has been insufficiently anti-Trump. Feinstein shocked a crowd she was addressing in San Francisco this summer when she declared that Trump can be a good president if he can learn and change, which is a big if. To talk about this race and what it can tell us about the future of the Democratic Party, we're joined by Dan Schnur of the Jesse M. Unruh Institute of Politics at the University of Southern California. Welcome, Dan.
Well, thanks for having me.
So what's the state of this race? Is Dianne Feinstein in the good graces of Democrats in California, or is she at risk of being unseated?
If Dianne Feinstein were a state legislator running for statewide office for the first time as a centrist and a bridge builder in this era, she wouldn't stand a chance. But, of course, she's been a senator for a quarter of a century now and has built up a tremendous amount of goodwill and stature and respect within the party. That makes this a tremendously uphill fight for any challenger, including Senator DeLeon. Kevin DeLeon brings a very unique biography to the race, which if anyone can take on someone like challenge, it's somebody with a background like DeLeon's. But it is decidedly uphill.
Katrina, is this, you know, we've seen so much over the last 10 years of all these primaries in the Republican Party and efforts to shift the party's caucus and Congress to the right. Is this a healthy, do Democrats need to do more of
absolutely.
This?
Absolutely. I'm a full believer in primarying conservative corporate Democrats. I think that's where we saw the Tea Party. I don't agree with Tea Party principles at all, but you saw the importance of primaries. And I think it's healthy. So in this case, you have it's not about Dianne Feinstein's age. It's about her value and priority. She's been out of sync, I think Dan would agree, with California for years. I mean, she was one of a few Democrats who voted for Bush's tax cuts. She voted for the Iraq War. And California is now the resistance state. The Democrats need to do more than resistance. They need to do a kind of resistance, renewal, reconstruction politics. But I do think you also need to see a new generation which will connect with the emerging coalition, which you particularly see in California, the rising American majority of Latinos, African Americans, young people. And so I do think what happens in California may well happen in other places. And we're seeing it at the local municipal level, big time. But I think it's an important strategy and tactic, primarying. And having robust primaries.
There is this wrinkle in California.
It's the
open primary.
Jungle. The jungle primary.
Because Katrina, you describe, I think you mean that Dianne Feinstein is out of touch with Democrats in California.
California's been Dan knows more about California, but it's been a Democratic state, and she's been out of sync with California for years, but California now has moved to the left as the Democratic Party has moved to the left. And so she's even more out of sync in a way on some core issues, not all issues, but on some.
But there's this interesting thing where because it's an open primary, all the candidates run in one primary, and the two candidates who get the most votes go to a general election. So it's very likely that we're going to have a general election between Dianne Feinstein and a Democrat to her left. And Dan, you know, there's still lots of Republicans in California, even though it's a heavily Democratic state. So it's basically, are Republicans likely to save her here? Because this system, this open primary system, was explicitly designed. It was supposed to promote the election of centrist candidates who could appeal across party lines. It kind of feels like Feinstein is the sort of person who ought to be a senator under that conception of the system, that it would mean that you could have moderate Democrats in the Senate from California.
Well, you're exactly right. The original sponsors of the top two primary believed that it would encourage voters in a non-represented general election to vote for the more moderate candidate of the other party. That simply hasn't happened. We've seen any number of congressional and legislative races where the two Democrats run against each other in a liberal community or two Republicans run against each other in a conservative area. And what happens instead is the voters from the party that isn't represented on the general election ballot just don't vote. They vote for the races where they see somebody with their party ID next to them. On the others, they opt out. That said, California Republicans right now are only slightly more numerous than independent voters here, or as we're known in California, no party preference voters. It's entirely likely that by next November, there will be more no party preference voters in California than Republicans. So even if all the Republicans just simply skip the United States Senate race in their ballot next fall, those independents, no party preference voters, could offer a level of protection to Feinstein that simply wouldn't be available to her in a more traditional arrangement.
Rich, you have some experience as a Republican in a jurisdiction dominated by Democrats. Do you see, I mean, having, you know, engaged in your, I mean, Republicans nominated Mike Bloomberg, who is essentially a moderate Democrat, to be mayor of New York City three times, built a coalition across lines to elect him. Do you see California Republicans deciding that they need a Feinstein coalition similar to the Bloomberg coalition?
Well, I don't know how that's... whether that really translates to statewide politics in California. I think Dan sounds right to me that Republicans just would tend to skip this race or races where there are no Republicans. And I have to say, in a jurisdiction where all I vote for is hopeless Republicans, it does still give me some psychic satisfaction to check that box.
More broadly, Dan, I feel like there's been this sort of progressive energy in the Democratic Party in California, a lot of it built around the idea of resisting Donald Trump, the state voting itself a sanctuary state, a big fight over a bill that would have purported to create a single payer system in the state. But then, I mean, for example, with the single payer bill, there were a number of basically asterisks left in the legislation. You wouldn't have been able to actually do it without a ballot initiative that would have been bruising. And I guess my question is, how much of this is really manifesting in changes in the way California is governed, changes that can be copied by other blue states, and how much of it is sort of a performance of opposition to the president and to Republican governance in Washington?
I don't know that you can separate the two. I wouldn't use the word performance, but I would say is that opposition to Trump has certainly accelerated the ideological shift. Going back to the point that Katrina was making a little bit earlier, it's worth remembering that Dianne Feinstein was elected to the Senate in 1992 when Bill Clinton was running for his first term as president as a self-proclaimed new Democrat. The party has been moving gradually leftward over the years, with the notable exceptions of the governor's office, where both Gray Davis and Jerry Brown have been somewhat more centrist. But to your point, I'd say opposition to Trump has taken a gradual shift leftward and accelerated it. Whether it's enough to take out an icon like Dianne Feinstein is another question. You know, political parties don't come with on-off buttons. They have dimmer switches. We have to see how quickly that shift has taken place, particularly against somebody with 25 years of political capital stored up.
I've been surprised that the disorderly primary process has been such an endemic feature of Republican politics and not on the Democratic side. On the left, you tend to romanticize the insurgents and the crusaders, and it just doesn't seem to show up in primaries the same way.
Shift, Dan. I mean, Dan was talking about 1992 Clinton. We're in a different era, and I think Bernie Sanders' insurgent candidacy and his post-campaign organization, Our Revolution, I like our evolution. But they're running candidates across the country in primaries. Now, it's under the radar because they're not even those special congressional elections which got all the attention. But the mayor of Birmingham, Alabama, Jackson, Mississippi. I mean, and part of the problem is we don't have a robust local state media anymore which covers those races. So the nation is paying attention to that. But you are seeing primaries.
On that note, we've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Dan Schnur, what do you want to rant about?
My pet peeve are pundits like us who tend to have focused selective outrage on the excesses of the other party. Where conservative pundits delight in these divisions like we're seeing with DeLeo and Clinton. Liberal pundits love to point out about how the Steve Bannon insurgency is making life miserable for the Republicans. I think it's worth noticing is that there's a real populist resentment in this country, which transcends left and right. And until we stop just pointing fingers at the other side, we're not going to successfully address it.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Jimmy Kimmel said in an interview that he doesn't care about Republican viewers who might be turning him off because of his political monologues and, quote, probably wouldn't want to have a conversation with them anyway. It's a dispiriting sign of our times that even our late night comedians want to play to their political bases and not talk to the other side.
Katrina Vandenhoeven.
I have more of a reflection than a rant. In these times, I try to go back to history for inspiration and encouragement. I've been reading Franklin Roosevelt's 1944 speech on the Second Bill of Rights. Freedom is such a contested term in these times. He writes, "We have come to a clear realization of the fact that true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence. Necessitous men are not free men. People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff of which dictatorships are made. I'd amend to add women, but I do think that that definition of freedom is one we should hold close to our hearts and mind in these times."
David Frum, what do you want to write about?
Well, while we're worried about the decline of freedom, let me note that the Czech Republic has an election this weekend for president, and it looks very likely that the last and best of the democracies of Central Europe is about to succumb to the same Russian-oriented authoritarian populism that has bogged down Hungary and Poland and Slovakia. I remember those magic days of 1989, we really do seem to be turning back the clock. And where is the United States as all of this happens?
Instead of a rant this week, I want to ask a quick favor from our podcast listeners. KCRW wants to learn more about you, who you are, and how you listen. If you have 3 minutes to spare, please head to kcrw.com/survey. We would love to hear from you. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenhoeven, David Frum, and Dan Schnur. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.